Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to a course in the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises Academy. This is World War I, Crucible of the Age of Statism. I'm Hunt Tooley, and we're working on Session 6, War Finance, War Control, the Health of the State. So welcome to this evening's version of this. I hope everybody had a good week. And just a quick housekeeping thing. I've gotten several of the essays, and I'll be grading them later this week, the ones that came in late last week and so forth. And if I don't get your essay, if somehow I overlook it and you're thinking about the grade, just send me an email and remind me, because sometimes I don't gather them all in one place. And so feel free to do that and communicate directly with me. That's no problem at all. So, and again, if you'd like to write one of these reading essays, even if you haven't written the previous ones, there's no, because the way the course is set up, we don't really make, and I don't really make a big deal about deadlines. So you can pretty much start out now. I mean, you have to do the reading, but if you wanted even to start out now and catch up with the reading, I don't think that would be impossible, because the reading is not that brutal. Otherwise, if you want to just write one for the heck of it, if you have some good ideas and you just want to get them on paper and get a reaction from me, you will certainly receive that. So do that if you like. I mean, I think there's a good point in taking the course for a grade, but also if you just get some response, that might be something that you would want. And it might be you don't want that at all, so that's fine too. So let's roll and talk about war finance, war control, and the health of the state. Well, how we want to proceed tonight, how I want us to proceed, is first of all, take a look at theory. As Mises said, you cannot have too much of good theory, and so we will have some good theory tonight. And we'll look at three theorists to kind of set the tone for us. Then I want to look at war bonds in particular and war collectivism in general. I do want to say about tonight's material, it is so extensive, the kind of treatment that we have to give in a short course like this, that we're going to pick and choose and kind of cherry pick some examples. We can't cover everything. We can't even cover all the issues of war finance. We'll just talk about what we can, and then you can bring up questions in the question and answer, and we can fill in. And we'll be talking more about all these aspects later on. But I do want to give you that sort of forewarning, or warned is forearmed, of course. And so war bonds and war collectivism, and you'll see what that is in a minute. And then at the end of war against the individual, all having to do with wartime treatments of the individual and of society by the state. So let's roll. Our first theorist tonight is Randolph Bourne, an intellectual, an American intellectual from the first part of the century. I am certain that nearly everybody in the course knows him. If you've done much reading, he is the person who invented the phrase, "A war is the health of the state." And it's a phrase that tells so much about our own times. And he was talking, of course, about World War I. Here's what he said. War is the health of the state. It automatically sets in motion throughout society those irresistible forces for uniformity, for passionate cooperation with the government in coercing into obedience the minority groups and individuals which lack the herd sense. So I think that this, although his essay is as rich as can be, the whole war of this, war is the health of the state essay, plus the rest of his writings, I think his opening shot kind of gives us a way in here, a way in which World War I provided governments with the opportunity to harness some members of the herd to be enforcers against the others. And I think that's a very important piece of theory. Our second intellectual, our second theorist is Rothbard. And his essay that I'm referencing is World War I as Fulfillment. And here's what Rothbard said, and I think it's important, again, to read these words of our theorists. In contrast to older historians who regarded World War I as the destruction of progressive reform, I'm convinced that the war came to the United States as the fulfillment, the culmination, the veritable apotheosis of progressivism in American life. I regard progressivism as basically a movement on behalf of big government in all walks of the economy and society, in a fusion or coalition between various groups of big businessmen, led by the House of Morgan, and rising groups of technocratic and statist intellectuals. In this fusion, the values and interests of both groups would be pursued through government. So it's fairly easy to get caught up here in the when we see the proper nouns in this theory, the House of Morgan. It's so important, as we've already seen. In other words, there's not a part of the war financing issue. There's not a part of the loan issue. There's not a part of even of the imperialist issue that you can reference without thinking about the House of Morgan, this extensive conglomeration of interests controlled by J.P. Morgan and his minions. But it's also true that we need to back up and say, look, this is an expansive kind of fulfillment. In other words, it's a fulfillment of a goal of big government in all walks of life. It's a fulfillment of these various interests and very quite extended interests of progressivism in all walks of life. So I want to make a note on this. And of course, this is all much of this is embedded in Rothbard. But let me just make a point of my own here. This localized statement that Rothbard makes for the American case in the war as fulfillment essay. With the change of just the proper nouns in it, and some of those not even changed, but with changes in the proper nouns, you can apply that to almost any country in the war. In other words, Hungarians, I put here Hungarians in the Austrian Empire, saw the war as they welcomed it, many of them, as a way to fulfill their national desires for more autonomy, perhaps even independence. Women in Britain saw the war as an opportunity. The Irish national revolutionaries, the autonomists, and so forth, saw the war as an opportunity. German socialists saw the war as an opportunity, and they said, well, you know, we've traditionally been against war, but we're going to vote for this one. We think we can move forward with our program more during the war. Some failed farmers in different places saw the war as an opportunity. Harbor masters, thinking their port was neglected, saw the war as an opportunity. You get the picture. In other words, there's a the fact of this democratic war, in essence, goes to the heart of the modern problem, and that is that everybody, as opposed to democracy being this kind of selfless, altruistic enterprise, it really was about societies built on gaining the most out of their fellow man, taking endlessly. A very good book, and I give you the note here on this. Not this particular issue, but just a history of the United States in the First World War is that book by David Kennedy over here, The First World War in American Society. And Kennedy is not necessarily like-minded. He's not a libertarian or an Austrian or even a paleo-conservative. David Kennedy is a great historian, a Stanford historian, now retired, I believe. And this is just a wonderful a wonderful piece of work on the whole rundown, a whole view of American society in the First World War. But the interesting thing is that even without thinking much about it, and he probably did think about it in a lot of different ways, but Kennedy makes the point over and over, well, here's a group that thought it could get something out of the war. Here are the group of black Americans or black elites on the East Coast, and yes, they think they can get something out of the war. Here's the group of whatever, and they think they can get it. So this is, I think, an important part of fulfillment. It's a fulfillment, said Rothbard, a culmination. Now, there's a second note that I want to make about fulfillment, and that is that almost none of these goals, none of these local programs, none of these group think kinds of wish lists were invented by the war. They didn't emerge during the war for the most part. I think it's really important to note, otherwise we get very confused when we get down to brass tacks and we say, well, this was invented by World War I, and then we can look back and say, oh, wow, this group was demanding this same thing in 1899 or whatever. So we have to understand that all of these tendencies that we see promoted by the war and that we're going to talk about this evening, these were all pre-existing. They were all in train beforehand. And that goes to the most abstract level. In other words, the growth of government, the ways in which government had taken over more and more parts of people's life, that didn't start in 1914 or 1917, of course. That had started much before. Big government, not born by the war, born in the war, but already in train, and it was the war that helped to fulfill that. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Our third theorist, the great gentleman Robert Higgs, a brilliant economist and economic historian, who wrote one of the best books you can think of, Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government. His basic premise is, in a way his book is so good, it's a little like the great blockbusters. It's like The Origin of the Species or Das Kapital or something. You really don't have to read it to talk about it even, but those of us who have read it love to talk about it even more. I guess I should have thrown the Bible in there. You really don't have to read it to talk about it, do you? So what Higgs said in his monumental book was that the size and power of American government didn't just creepingly get bigger. It didn't just incrementally get bigger, but that over time, if you follow a number of indices, which are really physically attached to the growth of government, the size of it, the number of employees, what its budget was, the extent of its controls in society, all these measures, then you figure out that it leaps forward in the time of a crisis. Could be an economic crisis, could be a terrorist attack, could be a war, could be whatever. And he shows then how this happened in succeeding circumstances, including World War I. It's a very, very crucially important point. I think that's something we want to think about, because as we look at these measures tonight, we're smack in the middle of this crisis of all crises, and so we want to keep the Higgsian kind of motivation and moment in mind. Okay, that was the theory. Never let a crisis go to waste. I like that, Cam. Very nice comment. So, let's go from theory to practice, and we'll talk about war bonds and other horrible things. I just throw at you this sort of Rockwellian painting from German society. There's so much in the wartime that resonates for us later on. There's a kind of pathos. There's a kind of civic aura that the practitioners of government used to cover over the horrific realities of war. I didn't put it in this week's material, but there's a very interesting set of books that were put out by various government-related publishers and some government agencies in 1916, 1917. I mean, 1916 was the turn of winter in Germany. People were actually, I mean, it kind of means we're glad if we can get some turnips and nothing else. It was a very, very cold winter, very tough, very ugly winter. People were starving. But on the other hand, the government pushed its writers to write little tomes about food and nutrition. Do we really need so much food? These days we don't get so much food and we think the quality's bad, but isn't it really a good thing that we don't eat so much? That isn't it a good thing? I mean, after all, I'd like to quote Dr. Schuchler, who tells us that human beings do very well on 1,000 calories a day, even under hard, serious, heavy labor. In other words, there are these books where, and these are lecturers also going around, the German version of the five-minute men in America went around giving speeches on how great it was to starve. So we get this kind of sugar coating, and this is, governments had done this before, but World War I really makes an art of it. So here are people lined up at the table here, and the sign in the painting up above says here, one can subscribe to the war loan. Isn't it wonderful? War loans, as we've already discussed, and as we'll discuss again, because it's a crucial and often ignored component of the war. All belligerents had to deal with these enormous spiraling costs, these titanic costs of modern war. And all of the belligerents used the full range of fiscal tools in one way or the other. They used inflation to transfer wealth. They used loans, and that means loans from other countries, loans from international banks, loans from individuals in the form of bond issues, etc. They used confiscation. They just found enemy aliens, confiscated their property. There was also a war booty. In other words, some things were issues of result of conquest, and they were brought back home. And then, of course, taxes, the most unpopular of all. We talked a good deal about inflation and also taxes, but it's very true that countries borrowed from their citizens. Now, the reason I include this measure here, and we're going to talk about it in some detail, is that the war bonds that each country offered had a kind of double-edged advantage. That people did buy Liberty Bonds, but they also got propagandized in the process. It was a win-win situation for the government if somebody stepped up to the plate, got in that line that we just looked at, and bought the bond, because it meant they were now linked into the war. They were now linked into the government. There was good feeling there. There was this kind of patina of civic pride, and we're all in this together. This elides together with the fact that we're at the last pre-electronic media stage of Western civilization here. We're at the last point at which mass communications are heavily reliant on placards and posters and little flyers and things like that, so that every European country had kiosks on every corner, in the United States too, right? Not just Europe, but in the United States and Canada and Australia. This was a common means of communication, and people were also received newspapers and so forth, but posters played a very important role. For one thing, the newspapers were not in color, the posters were. A poster could, it had been raised to the level of an art form in other ways, and it was harnessed. Many of the poster makers were harnessed for the war effort. So you get a wide range of posters. So we're going to look at some posters here in a second. Let me give you an example. I'm not going to go across the board and tell you how each program went, but this is the this is an example. From 1914 to 1918, the German government issued nine war bond series, bringing in about 98 billion marks. That's just enormous. Now, the currency was being inflated at the same time. So by the end, we're not bringing in as many. But the hyperinflation did not start until 1920. In fact, there was a relief in 1919, and it really shot up in 1920. So what we're looking at here is about 60% of the German war costs being financed through these loans from private citizens, which makes the end of the war, the loss of the war, the inflationary period even more of a disaster if you think about that. Here's a German call for turning in your gold, March 5th, 1915. Gold belongs to the Reichsbank. That's the central bank, right, in Germany. Every German can contribute to a victorious conclusion of the war. Everyone who's willing to help can strengthen the financial powers of the Reich. Nothing will achieve this end more effectively than immediately depositing into the Reichsbank all gold. This gold will otherwise continue to circulate superfluously in great quantities or even sit unused in vaults. That would be terrible, wouldn't it? For each 20 marks in gold, the Reichsbank will exchange 60 marks in banknotes. So, to the Reichsbank with all the gold still in private hands, gold coins will be accepted at all public state teller booths and at all savings banks, from which it will be transferred to the Reichsbank. And this is just an appeal from the city of Königsberg, March 5th, 1915, very early in the war. And we've already talked about this, but there's a feeling here. We can all help. You can all help by turning in your gold. So in the same spirit, these war bond kinds of things were issued. It's a part of civic pride. Here's a couple of American posters. Joan of Arc, save France, save your country, buy war savings stamps. That's another formal lesser valuations of war bonds. And then, of course, they beat back the Hun with Liberty Bonds. There's the evil Hun, the blood dripping off his bayonet, bloody hands, grim, monstrous face. But we can beat back that Hun with these war bonds and be as pure as Joan of Arc while we do that. Here's another one I like very well. It's about as soppy and as you could possibly get. The third Liberty loan. Goodbye, Dad. I'm off to fight for old glory. You buy U.S. government bonds. And I'm sure his dad said, wow, okay. No doubt about that. Fatuous, of course. Here's the French version of the war loans, and they had their own series after series in the same way that the United States did. Not called Liberty Bonds, but the national loan or the national bond, the Emprunt National. And this is one of the ones from 1918, so that we can make entire the sweet land of France, meaning that a big part of it was being occupied by Germans, and so you want to loan your money to the government for that purpose. Here's a beautiful poster. I love this poster. This is an Austrian poster, the fourth Austrian war loan. Everybody had them. I mean, all the belligerents had to do this. So here's the message is not quite clear. I mean, I think you just heroically kind of wave the flag and buy the loan. I don't know if that's as effective an argument, but it's a nice poster. And here's a German one. Sign up for the third war loan, 5.5% profit. So there's the knight defending civilization against the hordes in the east, et cetera, and his wife is back there. She looks a little bit Clintian in that picture. Some of these posters are quite quite persuasive and quite stylistically good. I don't think this one is. The Indian Warlow, 1918. And I've tried to figure out this little poem. Maybe you can figure out what the heck that's all about. We have played our parts and have kept your mark. Come ye and lend your gold. Maybe that's a poem. Maybe that's, I don't think that's Kipling. I don't think he ever wrote anything that bad, but maybe somebody will figure it out. I bet Cam has it pasted up here before I get to the next slide. So anyway, you kind of get these war loans as a part of this weird wartime mood. And of course, there were so many other aspects of the war economy that we don't have time to discuss. There's the government intervention at every level. There are government price controls and wage controls. There are government attempts to control the price of all the staple carbohydrates in each country. There are government controls of lumber and especially industrial fats. I mean, as these societies get hollowed out, in particular the industrial fats and all fats. In other words, even non-industrial fats are converted to gear grease for trucks and cannons and whatnot. So you get all these interventions into the economy that have never happened before. As we've mentioned already, the unions get kind of co-opted into the sphere of government, which is relatively appropriate. They had been recognized by the government, and the government makes teamwork with them. But I want to explore just for a moment two kind of forgotten episodes that I think are so instructive that fit in with this mood of the posters. I guess we could call it adventures in wartime economic intervention. Because the capitals immediately began this wonderful progressive fashion of planning from the top down, the total control. All of the war leaders were all confirmed top down technocratic individuals, and collectively they formed technocratic governments. Well, I ran across something in the Guildhall Museum in the Guildhall Museum archive a few years back, and it was a story. I don't know if it's ever been published anywhere, but I've never seen it anywhere but in the original kind of booklets put out by these offices after the war. Here's what happened. If you've ever been to Wales, you know that if it ever stops raining, you better enjoy it because it's going to start again in a minute. And it's a place that, because of this rain, has tremendous grass, and because of tremendous grass and it's part of a greater economy, then most of the farming has to do with sheep. And there are other goods. I mean, there are farm items that can survive really heavy soil and a lot of wetness and dampness. I mean, turnips work well, those kinds of things. But as far as that goes, wheat was, insofar as anybody ever grew it, it was given up. And indeed, some hotshot young Cambridge and Oxford experts in London discovered in the probably pouring through old tomes in the library that once upon a time the Welsh grew a lot of wheat. And of course, once Britain could ship in cheap wheat from Egypt or America or later other places, then it made absolutely no sense for anybody to try to grow wheat. For one thing, if you're from the wheat country, and I'm sure some of you are, you know that you have to have dry weather to harvest the wheat, or it just rots in the field. So the wheat production, such as it ever was in medieval Wales, was nothing to write home about. But the brilliant economic planners in London, all young men, I believe, I think that was in the account that I read, they were all young bureaucrats, they went west to Wales, and they decided to persuade the Welsh farmers to get back to wheat. And so they tried to persuade farmers, and they made very little headway. So what what they did actually was to mobilize county councils and local councils of good men and true, who would then go as a committee or group of war committee folks to the farmers and browbeat them into growing wheat at the same time as they brought economic incentives, because they would pay the farmers something to grow the wheat. You see how this is all working out in relationship to modern agriculture? They do this, and the Welsh farmers, I mean, they take the money from London. I mean, it's money. They take some of their sheep pastures and plow them up and plant wheat. But of course, the end of the story is that there were fewer sheep produced, and money had to be spent for these sheep farmers to reimburse them from the incentive promised. But on the other hand, there was no wheat forthcoming. So in this case, it's Welsh sheep who are taking up unneeded space, kind of useless eater sheep. But the German pigs are in fact more insidious. Pigs are of course a staple of German farming, and pork is a staple of the German diet. It's one of the main protein sources. Another staple, of course, is potatoes. I mean, if you think about pork and potatoes, you can think of a lot of different German dishes that consist of those. Well, in the autumn of 1914, what happened was this. The German government, once the war had started, immediately issued a price ceiling on potatoes. That harkened back to all the war measures going way back to the French Revolution and every other time. In other words, you keep the working classes, especially the urban working classes, linked up to the central government by promising them that war will not make their staples more expensive, and especially bread, and especially in the German case, potatoes. So the idea was that by putting a price ceiling on the price of bread, of potatoes, that all would be well, and that this would satisfy the workers who were sacrificing their brothers and cousins and sons and whatnot for the war effort, in great numbers too. So the farmers who had produced potatoes and just produced a big crop realized that they couldn't get a normal price for them, and indeed they found out that it was hauling them to market was too expensive to even cover the cost with the new low price ceiling. And so they began to feed the potatoes to their hogs. They thought, at least we can make use of the potatoes as feed for the hogs. This news leaked out to news reporters in Berlin, who made into it a sensational story about how German workers in Berlin were being starved at the expense of German hogs who were living, you might say, high off the hog, eating white potatoes for every meal. Not a chicken in every barn, but I guess potatoes in every pig slop yard. So these pigs were faring very well at the expense of the workers, and a hue and cry went up, and people protested in the streets. So the government said, that's okay, we can fix that too from our central location here in Berlin. We know how this should go. And that is to say, we can take some of the 27 million hogs in Germany and just kill them off. And so the swine, Schweinmord, the pig slaughter, pig murder, had its beginning. And so agents of the government went out to farms all over Germany and killed 9 million pigs over the course of a few months. So here we have a wonderful scenario. Germany, starved by the blockade already, and they're killing the pigs that could have fed people. So here are the absurdities of the kind of intervention that happened, and the waste and whatnot. Well did Ludwig von Mises say that it's the amazing thing is that with these types of waste and this type of illogical, uneconomic thinking, it's just good that the private enterprise, that the free market system had bolstered these countries up so that they survived as long as they did. It really is quite astounding. Let's turn now to the war against the individual talk a little bit about some aspects of that. Again, we can't be comprehensive in any sense here, but I do want to bring some of these issues up. And I'll start this by just looking at this nice group setting. You know, I think this is an analog to the painting we saw of the war loans, the German war loan poster above, Norman Rockwell view of a lot of nice ladies who've gone to work for the war effort, well-dressed, well-heeled, hair all pinned up, and they sit at these tables censoring mail. Actually, the officers, you can see the officers in the distance. Back, the column on the right, it just look to the just left of that, you can see the military officers who are posted there to double-check all problematic censorship issues. So there were places where people went to work doing this kind of censorship. In this case, I believe they were censoring prisoners of war letters, but they censored all kinds of letters, soldiers' letters and the private citizens and so forth and so on. The post offices became important places for state politics during the war. George Creel, pictured here, had a lot to do with a kind of part of the censorship efforts in the United States, but he's more concerned with him here as a part of this sort of fatuous, comfy wartime view of the civic duties and the kind of coziness of being a patriot and being a part of all this effort. George Creel was a journalist who supported Woodrow Wilson, was a progressive in his thinking, and was able to get a post in Wilson's government once the war started, and that was in 1917. That was as head of the Committee on Public Information, a new public communications office that Woodrow Wilson set up to communicate to the nation. Creel thought of himself as the grand communicator. Maybe he would have made up that title for himself. It sounds like a progressive 20th century title, the grand communicator. But in his book, How I Advertised America, he describes, again, in these sort of fatuous, enthusiastic tones that really mark the total state of the 20th century, the ways in which he thought censorship should be carried out, the ways in which he thought encouragement should be carried out, and so forth. He created a government agency of 37 departments, and among these, the Division of Pictorial Publicity, which both censored and distributed, the 4-Minute Men Division. In that one, he organized volunteer groups all over the country where they sat around and read instructional manuals and then went out on the public squares, to movie theaters, to schools, and in other places, and gave 4-minute speeches, and at the end of which they gave an appeal for people to buy Liberty Bonds. So they were the 4-minute men all over the country. Wouldn't you love to see one of them stand up before the movie starts? The news division, carefully chosen, and the censorship board. He argued against some of the censorship that Wilson and his cabinet members wanted to carry out. Much stricter ideas were held by the Attorney General and the Postmaster General. But in fact, he thought that over-censorship might discourage people. He wanted nothing that would lead to demoralization. He wanted to build up. He wanted to show the American story. He wanted to show how Americans could impact the world in this war. But, you know, Creel, and he's a famous person in the American war effort, has not so famous analogs in the other countries too. I mean, and they each have a particular style that goes along with the country. I mean, Creel is a very American type, of course. His counterpart was this man, whose name was Deutel Moser, and you'll never remember that name. I don't think I even wrote it down here, but he was the press officer for the first for the German army and later for the Foreign Office, and then they made an office for him, very much like the Committee on Public Information. It was called the Central for the Homeland Service, the Central for the Homeland Service, the Zentrale für Heimatdienst. And as the head of this office, Deutel Moser carried out with all of his agents and throwing out money to painters and writers and artists and speakers. He wanted to enlighten the public. Now, it's interesting that the word propaganda at this time was used quite casually by most participants in the war, especially in the first part of the war. Propaganda for World War I governments did not yet have the terrible pejorative overtones that we give to it, or at least it didn't have all of them. In discussions at government levels, there's quite frank discussions about, well, what's the propaganda? What will we propagate for this particular story? And it's more a kind of, it doesn't have this extra pejorative connotation yet. And so all of these guys, the Deutel Moser and Creel and all the rest, had in their minds what they were propagating and what there was to propagate, that is propaganda. Another area of control and of wartime power was, and of the government's war against the individual was, of course, conscription. And I want to talk about that for a few minutes now as a bridge to other topics. All the Central Powers and all the Entente Powers already had military conscription, except in the very beginning of the war, the British Empire Powers and the United States in 1917. In Britain, the Military Service Act of January 1916 was only then instituted conscription in England. And this Military Service Act was broadened and brought in, of course, more and more people into the mix. At some times it narrowed because they wanted some workers to have exemptions and so forth. Manpower was the major issue. Everybody understood this in the war. And this is one reason that women came into the workforce in such great numbers, so everybody's concerned with how to have all these soldiers in the field and also all the workers in the factory and many other ranges of people who are not normally in the workforce besides women joined the workforce, teenagers, younger people, and so forth. Canada followed suit in late 1916 with the Military Service Act. New Zealand introduced the same thing in 1916. The Australians, however, defeated moves to conscript Australians. And it's also true that the Australians were more enthusiastic than any of these other countries in signing up. They had a greater number of people enlist. But it didn't happen without protests. And indeed, although the Canadian government, the sort of national liberal government that we've discussed already, was tied into the Conscription Act, the Military Service Act, the French Canadians had a reserve of resistance against this, and a reserve of, you might say, individualism, and a reserve of anti-British feeling in any case. So that Wilfrid Laurier was singled out as somebody who didn't like this. And you see in this, in the poster on the left, the Kaiser is saluting the policies of the complaints of Wilfrid Laurier against conscription. And then there's an anti-conscription poster on the right that says we will have you, and that's again a French Canadian kind of issue. So all these countries adopted conscription, and this sets the stage, of course, for later times. But I should say also that all the Continental armies, France, Germany, Russia, of course, the Ottoman Empire, all Austria, all these countries had carried out conscription anyway. Well, once there's conscription, then there are conscientious objectors. They're in all countries, and they were treated during World War I with usually with great contempt, often with great brutality. Though frequently, once the war got going, many people who were conscientious objectors agreed to do war-related work that didn't have to do with any sort of combat. Ann Yoder, who is the librarian or the archivist at the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, gives us, I think, good information here. 3,989 men declared themselves to be conscientious. Why can't I say that? Not objectors. Of these, about 1,300 chose non-combatant service. Some worked on farms. Some did reconstruction work with the American Friends Service. And then 450 were sent to prison, and some remained in the internment camp. So there's prison, internment camp, forced labor, that's a fairly small range of work. There were certainly protests to all this. I just include these photographs as a kind of record. I mean, there was a much protest against conscription from objectors who had religious objections, Jehovah's Witnesses, the historic peace churches, the Mennonites and Amish, of course, the Quakers, and also then on the left, the International Workers of the World were dead set against the war. Any anarchist group was, of course, against the war. And all of these folks were persecuted in some degree, in some measure. All were handled roughly in that day and age. In fact, they were handled roughly, and I'm moving on to another topic now. Handled roughly, especially because the various acts. We've already seen the British DORA Act. When the United States got into the war, immediately. The Congress passed acts that Wilson had been calling for. You can see here since December 1915, there are citizens of the United States, he said, who have poured the poison of disloyalty in the very arteries of our national life. Who have sought to wring the authority and our good name of our government into contempt. I'm sorry, that should be bring them into contempt to destroy our industries and to debase our politics to the uses of foreign intrigue. We're without adequate federal laws. I'm urging that you do nothing less than save the honor and self-respect of the nation. Well, the Congress did that with the Espionage Act of June 1917. And it's interesting, it harkens back to an act that was already on the books. These movements, in other words, there's a kind of fulfillment here. Those folks who had wanted to push for the Defense Secrets Act of 1911, which first in American life first criminalized the spilling of secret government information. Those folks now had a field day, and as you can imagine, nobody ever thinks that the bill that they got passed does enough or goes far enough. Well, these folks didn't either, and so the Americanists, the preparedists, the progressives and the non-progressives who wanted greater preparedness and a more total government, had it in mind to expand these laws. And when the war came, in exactly the same way as when the terrorist deed was committed on 9/11, then the organs of government sprang into action and used the event as a springboard to expand things. Indeed, as the first troops were killed in the war, then the Espionage Act was expanded in 1918, and the expansions, which were really just extensions of the Espionage Act, those expansions have come to be called the Sedition Act, the whole thing, the total package, the Sedition Act. And so people were prosecuted all over the country for making light of patriotism, for saying the war was unnecessary, for engaging in any sort of public talk that looked like it was defeatist. People who were socialists were lock, stock, and barrel, for the most part, against the war. Eugene V. Debs, of course, the famous American socialist, was thrown into jail on the basis of the Espionage Act. And other people, IWW, the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, were hunted down in droves and jailed. Various kinds of anarchists, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses or the Watchtower Society, as they were called, and very generally anybody else who turned out to be the dreaded naysayer in public and sometimes in private were brought before the law, and about 1,000 convictions resulted. And many of these convictions resulted even as the war ended and served their sentences after the war. Wilson pardoned a few, but there were still plenty left to be pardoned by Harding when he came to office. So Harding, in the first part of his administration, pardoned most of the rest of these 1,000 who had been convicted and were still serving their sentences. Well, every other country had these sedition acts. Indeed, in Germany, in Austria-Hungary, in France, there had already been sedition acts on the book before World War I. But in the English-speaking countries in general, there was not such a thing. Dora was the pattern, plus some earlier British laws that led up to the Defense of the Realm Act in 1914. And then the other countries, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, Newfoundland, all of these followed suit as soon as England did that, and then the United States did too. There were certainly protests, as I've mentioned. Must Liberty's Lights Go Out? Hurrah for that. It's a good poster. Then the top poster there is a more of a cartoon than a poster. It's a Eugene V. Debs from his prison cell with a kind of smart remark against President Wilson. Two ladies down below protesting the unconstitutional nature of the Espionage and Sedition Act. And so there were certainly protests, but of course we know what happens in wartime when the protesters get out and about. Another aspect that governments took up almost immediately once the war started was the issue of enemy aliens. Now, I would like us to think for just a few minutes about defining the enemy. Back in European history in the 30 Years' War, civilians were fair game for every government. This was in the 1600s, from 1618 to 48. It was the time of incipient absolutist governments, and so governments really, for the first time in European history, were making the claim that everybody was liable to be pulled into a war, to supply a war, to be expropriated, to have stuff confiscated, and so forth and so on. In earlier times, many classes in society had been excluded. Even Machiavelli himself in the early 1500s said, here's the thing you want to make sure about, that you don't mess around with peasants. Let them produce. If you're going to take a country, don't mess with the peasants. Let them produce for you, but this is our lifeblood, to have people who are producers. So there are views on this that actually intensified during the 1600s with the rise of absolutist governments who laid an absolute claim to have everybody in society locked and loaded and as a part of the war effort. And then in the late 17th and in the 18th century Enlightenment, there's a huge intellectual movement that actually impacted kings really moved the enlightened despots to sponsor laws, to sponsor habits and customs and treaties and whatnot that provided for a limitation of war. There was a kind of pragmatic quality to that because each king thought that they would do better if he didn't kill other people's peasants, and that way they wouldn't kill his peasants. But still in all, there's this limitation of war, and frankly, although war got to be bigger and more grandiose in the 19th century, it's still the case that when people committed atrocities against peasants, when soldiers committed peasant atrocities, they were often called down. It was not treated as if it were the soldiers' right to rape and pillage and loot, and frequently a general's understanding that this made for disorder in armies, and they didn't like that, then they would hang a few soldiers to encourage the others not to do this cruelty. So then at the end of the century, there are these international agreements at The Hague and then others further down the line that are supposed to limit war. But as we've seen, the war immediately responded to these movements with a lot of brutality. The generals responded with brutality. The soldiers responded with brutality, impacted by social Darwinism and imperialism and so forth. But for the societies at large, then we almost start to re-expand our ideas of who the enemy is. In the 19th century, there really was not a category used of enemy aliens. Only in a very limited sense, and only with the idea that, well, what do we do with aliens? Somebody who's on vacation in England from France, and we happen to be at war with France, what happens to those people? We just want to make sure that that no spying goes on, and if we're worried about that, or that people, if they have a place to stay, we make sure that they get some relatives at home to send them money, so that they're not on the cost of the state. And things like that. But in the run-up to World War I, as I think we've seen, and as I'd like to reiterate, there's a very intensive idea about who constitutes the enemy. I wrote an article a few years ago in the Independent Journal about Sherman, General Sherman, as the Commandant of Memphis, who started looking on his area, his military governor of Memphis, in a very modern way. He wrote to his wife, we can't do anything here. All the people are now guerrillas. We're gonna view everybody as guerrillas, and that way it's fair game on anybody we want to shoot. So it's almost like saying, well, everybody's a terrorist, so we can shoot in any direction and do whatever we want. So there's this expansion of the idea of the major powers was, and lesser powers too, by the end of the 19th century. Well, it's true that we don't shoot at civilians, but what if civilians shoot at us? Doesn't that mean that we can open fire on everybody, do reprisal shootings, and all these kinds of things? So by this definition, that you get to the point of trying to define who's the enemy. Now, I submit to you this is an extremely important aspect of 20th century totalitarianism. The totalitarian regimes were much concerned with this very issue: who is the enemy? Who can we put in our sights legitimately? And they spent a lot of time and effort. In the case of Stalin, he didn't spend a lot of time or effort making this in any way in accordance with fairness or accuracy or law or anything like that. In the Third Reich, there's a whole office of the SS devoted to who is a Jew, the idea being that Jews were by definition enemies of the state. And so you get this whole way of looking at people in the 20th century as enemies because they're of a different religion or a different ethnicity or whatever. And so I think the treatment of enemy aliens and the treatment of folks seen to be with the enemy in World War I is a crucial part of this story that we're attempting to go through. So there wasn't much of a category of enemy aliens before the war. It did exist in law, but people didn't use it very commonly. But once the war started, immediately every country interned its enemy aliens or worse. And so I want to talk a little bit about this. And I'll take the worst cases first, Russia and the Ottoman Empire. The Russians knew who their internal enemies probably were. In Russia, right in the rear lines behind the Western fronts, both in Ukraine, behind the Austro-Hungarian front, and in Lithuania and Belarus, behind the Prussian, the northern German front, there were about there were huge populations of Jews. This was, after all, the Pale of Settlement, where the Russians had driven all their Jews, the place from which Jews were escaping to all over the world in the three decades before World War I. But there were plenty of Jews still left there. Two-thirds of all European Jews lived in this area. And the Russians knew who their allegiances might run to because the Jews almost exclusively spoke Yiddish, and the Russians thought of Yiddish as simply a German dialect. And so to the Russians, the Jews, if they were going to be loyal to anybody, wouldn't be loyal to the Russians. I mean, there's a pretty good argument for that, too, as many pogroms as the Russian state had and Russian localities had carried out against Jews in the 30 years preceding. But in any case, the idea is that as the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians attack, then what we need to do is make sure we're not stabbed in the back by these populations of Jews who will sympathize with the Germans or with the Austro-Hungarian armies. And so these Jews were simply deported. In spite of the fact that over 400,000 Jews were mobilized into the army, there were 80,000 Jews eventually served in the front lines. But what happened was that there were scenes of ethnic cleansing that were massive. The Russian forces drove thousands, tens of thousands of Jews in the winter of 1914-15 just into wastelands away from their homes. Many more that were deported on railroad trains, although many of the generals stopped that deportation because all the people were blocking the railway lines and they couldn't get ammunition to the front. Most of these deportations were then taken, the deportation people, the deportees, were taken far to the east, usually to Central Asia, almost always to some forsaken place, oftentimes with no town whatsoever, just dumped in the middle of nowhere and left. The mortality rates among these people, so handled, jammed into transports and sent off, were extremely high. Maybe a third of these people died. And the estimates are that that there were probably 20,000 or so who died in this process. And that's just the Jews, because there was somebody else who was targeted too, and that was, of course, the Germans who lived in Russia. German settlements were all over Western and even Central Russia, and in the Volga region as well, Southern Russia. And many of these Germans, extremely large numbers, were deported and also were killed in this process. So the picture here is some Jews who have been deported and are living, bunches of them, to a room in Samarkand or someplace like that. They're lucky to have that roof over their heads, because not all the deportees did. So these people were determined to be enemies, and they were gotten rid of. An even more extensive case of the same thing, and again in the same zone of the world. In other words, if you draw this zone down that goes through the Pale Settlement, the zone of conflict between Germans and Slavs and so forth. It just goes right down into the Ottoman-Russian border as well. And on this border, the Caucasus theater actually bisected Armenia. The Armenians are, of course, an old and storied Christian population that came to be in the Ottoman Empire, had been a part of the Byzantine Empire before that. And because of power politics and wars, they had ended up in a divided way so that there were Armenians on both sides of the line. However, there was enough discrimination against Christians in the previous 50 years, 60 years of the Ottoman Empire, that the Armenian populations were thought to be not especially loyal by the new nationalist, technocratic, positivist, progressive leadership in Istanbul. And so the leading troika of three dictators decided to remove from the rear areas of the Russian army all of the Armenians. There have been a number of behind the lines excursions. It appeared that Armenians in the rear areas were joining up with some of the Armenian paramilitary groups, that they were signaling the Russians and so forth and so on. And so they just hauled them away. They got up special units to do this, the special organization it was called. Many of those people were criminals, let out of prisons to do that. And what people called the Armenian genocide then went in train. In some parts of the world, there's still a debate about the very nature of this killing. We don't know all the facts. We know a lot. We know that some elements of the government view this as a kind of systematic killing. Genocide, I think, is a very unhandy word. It papers over some things, and it doesn't go far enough for others. And so I think this is problematic in many ways. But I think it's not an issue that about 700,000, at least 700,000 Armenians died, and maybe more, maybe considerably more. There was violence when they were driven from their homes. There was a lot of cupidity. There was a lot of theft. There was a lot of expropriation. Then these Armenians were driven southward into barren regions, treated horrifically, killed in masses by the brutal special organizations, and sometimes by locals as well. And they died of starvation. They died of disease, all these, the typhus and other diseases that people get from being driven, herded together in mass groups. And indeed, here you see even a camp in the photograph on this slide. Even in the wake of this destruction of people, the orphans, children are in a camp together, all herded together. I mean, in a way, the camp, whether it's an internment camp or a relocation camp or a deportee or a refugee camp or a concentration camp, all of this is formed in this period. Barbed wire is now available. It can be done. The British and the Americans and the Spanish have experimented with, and now it's known that you can pen people in these huge areas. So it's the age of mass internment. Here's another example of it. Although the Armenians, frankly, were not interned, and there were some camps set up for them where they died of disease and brutality, but for the most part, they died being beaten to death in the desert or starving to death or whatever. It's important to note a couple of things, and we don't know the whole issue here. Although it's a very sensitive issue. You know, it's illegal in France to say that the Armenian murders were not a genocide. I think that Raphael Lemkin's term genocide is quite problematic and has caused many more problems than it's solved. But In Turkey, then, it's not, you're illegal if you say that that the killings constituted a genocide. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, especially if you go back and forth between Turkey and France. It's clear that the special teams carried out things that seemed systematic. It's clear that some regional governors cooperated. Indeed, all of this happened in 1915. And in 1916, the central government put on trial some 1,300 men who had participated and found many guilty and executed at least one district government for his part in all this. But whether the government was then covering over its plans to decimate the Armenians or knock down their numbers in some way, it's beyond doubt that the government was not trying to kill every last Armenian, because the Armenians in Istanbul were not affected at all. So as Gunter Levy pointed out a few years back, that would be like saying, well, there's the final solution to the Jewish problem, but we're not going to do anything with Jews in Berlin. So that's the picture here. And I want to address that quite directly. I mean, we don't know everything about this, and I'm not, I think we'd have to define our terms first and talk about genocide, which I think is a very problematic and even tendentious term. Murder happened, brutality happened, that's for sure, and even in larger doses than the Russians handed out. But again, it's in this section of the earth. It's in times of severe privation. It's the times where the state has created, in both Russia and in the Ottoman Empire, this machine of brutality, and then taken from people their very conditions for living. So there's privation all over the place. Some 30% of many of the regions in eastern Turkey starved to death, whether they were Muslims or Christians. So. But it's in my view, it's another part of it's a kind of a continuum of what happened in the war that depended on outlooks of the governments, the level of advancement and of sort of westernization of the countries, and then of course the situations that arose. So. Those are the two worst cases, but, you know, we can look at all the other cases. Everybody interned their enemy aliens. The Germans interned their enemy aliens. The French interned their enemy aliens. I think that goes without saying. We all understand that. But I want to talk about some of the Entente internments. In Australia and New Zealand, there was a very important internment of enemy aliens. There were about 100,000 Australians, and who weren't actually aliens, they were just of German descent. And eventually, some 4,500 of those were interned in a camp system, which included not total brutality, but certainly privation in many ways. And most of those were eventually deported and expropriated. New Zealand had only a few, but also had its own camp. Here's a picture of an internment camp in New Zealand for its few hundred folks. Canada interned several thousand people. It registered 88,000 enemy aliens, so identified, and in the War Measures Act of 1914 set the stage for enemy alien treatment that went all the way up till 1920, as it did in most places. All enemy aliens had firearms prohibited. Gradually, many of the males, and I think this was almost totally males in the Canadian case, it was not only males in the Australian case. Many women were interned in Australia. But gradually, all the male enemy aliens or specially identified, specially dangerous ones were rounded up. And something below 9,000 were interned in one of 24 camps, and almost all put to hard labor in the Canadian case, or labor in mines, in farms, roads, and so forth. The great ski area, Banff, in Western Canada, the place that's so fashionable to go to now. Much of those roads and much of the infrastructure there was developed by these hardworking folks. They were mostly Ukrainians. There were Germans and Turks in Canada who had not gotten a passport, who had not become naturalized citizens, and so were aliens. But for the most part, these were people who had immigrated and part of the flow of immigrants to the United States and Canada and to the Americas, and who had started a farm and were working peacefully, and then they were interned and worked for the state. So it's a very grim case. So I guess those guys are carrying wood up there to do work in Banff or some other place. America had its own internment. 250,000 enemy aliens were registered. About 6,300 eventually were interned in camps, mostly men, I believe. There could have been some women, but I haven't seen any records of that. In Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, and Fort Douglas, Utah. In other words, remote places where if they escaped, there'd be a sort of hard way to do that. Every place where you couldn't escape. Most places used islands if they had any, but we put our internees remotely, most of them in Fort Douglas, Utah. About 1,800 merchant sailors were declared enemy aliens, were declared actually POWs, although they just worked on commercial ships that happened to be docked at American ports when the war broke out. But they were all rounded up and put into camps. One of the main camps for them, I think the main camp, was Hot Springs, North Carolina, though some were sent to the other two enemy alien camps. I want to point out this picture here is a photograph of Fort Douglas, the literary circle of Fort Douglas. I mean, there were all kinds of people in these camps. There were workers, but there were especially literary people. And indeed, literary people and artists were thought to be more dangerous. I think there were 29 members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra who were arrested and determined to be enemy aliens and sent to camps. Numerous composers throughout the country, and orchestras large and small, artists and so forth. And so it's not surprising that this literary circle makes its emergence in Utah. In these camps, they really had not much to do. And so, and this is the experience of most of the camps in the English-speaking world. By the way, the man who ran the camp system is before you there in a picture, a very flashy, natty J. Edgar Hoover, who at 22 years old became the head of the enemy alien registration section of the Justice Department, and used that as a springboard to achieve all the things he did achieve. British internment is extremely interesting to me. I've done a good bit of research on this in recent years. I gave a paper on mainly devoted to this at the Mises Conference a couple of years ago, and it's a topic that's really important to me, and I think it's really important in this whole system of the 20th century and its decisions to lock people up and keep them locked up. So the British immediately interned about 30,000. I shouldn't say immediately. They registered the enemy aliens and began to think about interning them, and then the Lusitania was sunk in early 1915. And in Liverpool, where most of the crew of the Lusitania came from, there were immediate riots. There were very vicious riots against people who were, there were especially German butchers in the United Kingdom. And people would find a butcher shop or another shop owned by a German, break into the shop, beat up or kill the owner, and so forth. So there's a widespread kind of lashing out against people who were thought to be German in the UK. And so immediately after the Lusitania riots spread from Liverpool to Birmingham and to Manchester and then to the rest of the cities, practically everywhere, every major city in England had a Lusitania riot, that's called. And This brought pressure on the British government, and so they just started arresting men. And in this case, it was all men. They took almost everybody to the Isle of Man. That's that island in the middle of the Irish Sea. So it's halfway, not quite, but it's about halfway between the mainland. Just a few hours ride from by ship from Liverpool, and just a couple of hours ride by ship from Dublin. So it's right in the middle, but it is an island. I mean, if you escape, you'd have to swim through the Irish Sea, which would be not a winning solution. But 30,000 were interned, some of them in the capital of the Isle of Man, which is its own country, part of the UK, but its own country nonetheless. That's its own currency today. It's not a part of the European Union. But on the western side of the island, at a place called Knock Alo, after they filled up all the hotels and so forth in Douglas, the capital, they built a camp. They brought they shipped in enemy aliens and had them build their own camp and put them in this setting. And I know this this picture is a very attractive picture. It's a painting of the camp by one of the inmates. I mean, they didn't have much to do, and many were highly, highly skilled and talented in many things. And so there's a lot of great artwork that comes from the camp. And this painting makes it look about as good as I can imagine. It's a fairly barren place. Just over those hills that you see there, they drop right off into the Irish Sea. I mean, and there, in the drop off is cliffs of several hundred feet in height, or a couple of hundred anyway. So this is Knock Alo, as it's called, and that's where 30,000 people lived a very rough, plain life. Most of these folks at the end of the war were looking at deportation. I'll say something more about that in a moment. There's a hero in the midst of it all, and I just want to make this clear. When you get into the facts of history, there are so few heroes. I mean, Austrians have their own set of them, but it's hard to find the heroes in the 20th century. Well, James Bailey was one of them. James Bailey was a friend. He was a British Quaker, and he wanted to do something in the war that would be of value. And he found out about the alien program. He found out that they were going to make a camp at Knock Alo, and he said, "So you're just going to intern those people, men in the prime of life, many of them, men who have jobs and are busy businessmen and craftsmen and so forth, and you're just going to have them sit there for the duration of the war?" So he finagled and wheedled the authorities, and eventually became industrial superintendent. That doesn't mean he was the commandant of the camp. He was not. But he was industrial superintendent, and as such, he was a link to the outside world. He could maintain some communications, and then on the inside of the camp, he set up workshop after workshop for these 30,000 men so that there were building. He was a conduit for getting saws and equipment and so forth so that men could carry out their trade, make other buildings, make crafts, do art. They keep themselves busy. There's a book about James T. Bailey. It's a little hard to find, but it's written in the 60s, I guess, by Leslie Bailey, Craftsman and Quaker, The Story of James T. Bailey. And his papers are at the museum in the Isle of Man, at the Manx Historical Museum Archive, and you see some of his papers there. I worked through a lot of his extensive notebooks, and he was a hero. I'd be glad to talk more about James D. Bailey and his further exploits, but a man of peace and a man of total conviction. It's the kind of person you don't run across very often. Oh, and I do want to say, before I get to my last little set of things, I do want to say that the typical person here was really a business owner. I mean, imagine in 1900, a German practitioner of, say, industrial embroidery, moves to London looking for a better wage, sets up a little shop eventually, has his own business working for different factories and doing different things, meets an English girl, marries her, they have kids, and 1914, 1915 comes and he finds himself in Nakhalo, and he finds his business ruined, hopes his wife can keep it going. In fact, I'm not telling you, I'm telling you a typical case, but it's a real case. The guy becomes more and more despondent. He sees his wife once or twice in the war. She can't afford to come. The children are being harassed at school. She tries to keep from home as much as possible. And then the war ends. He's there through 1919 because the British don't let anybody loose. And when they finally let him loose, they deport the greater part of these internees to Germany. So he moved from Germany 20 years before, became English in every respect, contributed to the economy, had English children, an English wife, and then he was deported to starving Germany. So this is the kind of process of these wartime justices and equities that we can talk about. Okay, well, finally, as a mass thing, I mean, it's I'll blame it on the state, the Spanish flu. All evidence points to the outbreak of the Great Spanish Flu to some of the military camps. A number of scholars think that the flu emerged in Fort Riley or one of the huge camps in Nebraska or North Texas. But other scholars are now thinking, I think the latest information, the latest view is really that it was at a couple, where they had not only soldiers, but a large number of geese who are carriers of virus, and pigs who are carriers of virus. See, the pigs really are bad. They should be murdered. Not true. I don't believe that at all. But at Etaples in northern France, where the British had 200,000 men continuously together in one place, that just gave them this out of the ordinary, atypical situation provided a breakthrough for that virus. I'm not saying the state intended this. I'm not saying the state put out the virus, but it was the arrangement of the warfare state that produced this disease, which globally killed from 20 to 100 million people. We will never know how many it killed. There were three waves of it, actually four or five waves of it. It was atypical of other viruses, but still nobody knows exactly why it was atypical. Militarily, it may have impacted the Central Powers more. They were weakened by hunger for the most part and lack of good nutrition, and it killed an awful lot of them, but it killed a lot of everybody. And certainly, it was an unfathomable, unplanned, but still direct result of the herd trend noted by Randolph Bourne, and whom he was a man himself whom the disease killed in 1919, one of the dreadful consequences and costs of the war. Okay, next week we have Titanic Wars. I'm ending a little late, but I am prepared to stay here for a while and answer questions. I know that some of you may not be able to do so. We got that late start, but I am more than happy to answer questions. So let's let the fun begin. Let me, before I see that John Anderson has a question, but let me run up and see if I missed any major things up above. John asks already earlier, all this top-down control was facilitated by Wilson, who believes central planning over individualism. Had Taft won the 1912 election, how differently do you think things would have played out? Well, that's a $64 question, isn't it? I don't know. Taft had his own set of problems, but he certainly wasn't Woodrow Wilson. And the Taft family is has a in a way a kind of place in the hearts of libertarians and paleo conservatives and Austrians. But it's also true that Taft was an empire man himself, and I'm not sure what would have happened. Well, we can't know what would have happened, but somehow I can't, I'm with you. I think things might have, if I take your suggestion, I think things might have gone a little bit differently. Let's see. I knew that Cam would come up with that line. Well done, sir. To the Men at Home by Thomas Russell. It must be a really schlocky poem. So there's a PDF of How We Advertise in America. You can get my Sherman article there. There's the Leslie Bailey book about my hero, James Bailey. Okay, John Anderson asks this now. The subjugation of basic civil rights by all warring powers and the accepted violation of constitutional rights in the U.S. is a fascinating aspect of the war is often overlooked, ignored, and completely unknown to most people. Tonight's topic should be expanded into a separate 46-week course. Okay, so not a question, but a statement. Well, I agree. I think it's really important. However, I do also think that, I think you obviously you could do that. But I think it's important also to understand how the parts and pieces work. In other words, I think one mistake that we might slip into just talking about these kinds of things is to have them out of the context of the war, which is really crucially important. The context of people losing this person in battle and that person in battle, their cousin, their sister, I mean their brother, or their sisters, their nurses killed too. Losing relatives, paying higher taxes, all these things. But there is this war going on, and the specific character of the war makes a big difference. So I think that's an important thing to keep in context. But I agree with you. We could take 4 or 6 weeks and more on that aspect of things. And, of course, we will be talking more. We have already talked a lot about these home front issues already. So I'm kind of parceling these out a little bit at a time. We may get 4 weeks out of them, out of the 8. I don't think so, but maybe, because we're talking about military and political and philosophical and so forth issues. Laura asks, this might sound too basic, but exactly what is a bond? What do people get in return for buying bonds besides feeling that they were contributing to the cause? Okay, a bond is simply a loan by you. So you buy, for example, a treasury bond, and it's a good question, by the way. It's not too simple at all. You buy a treasury bond for $100, and they say, well, in 3 years, we'll give you your money back plus whatever the percentage, whatever the rate of return. Say it's a 4% bond. In 3 years, we'll pay you back your money and pay you 3%. So you are the lender when you buy the bond, and whoever issues the bond, whether it's a city or a government, or whether it goes to some private company, then they're the debtors, and you're the creditor, and then you just hope that everything goes okay. And it's not like any other loaning. I mean, you're betting there that the inflation doesn't creep up and ruin the loan, but whatever the case, it's just simply borrowing. So these governments borrowed, you know, they would make a deal with J.P. Morgan or with Jacob Schiff or with Baron de Rothschild and borrow money directly from these big banks. Or they would make deals with foreign governments who sometimes loaned money across these lines on a temporary basis that would be backed by banks and backed by different kinds of collateral and things like that. But they also, all the powers also borrowed money in continuously enabling all kinds of banks to put out bond issues and make it available and set up tables at the bank for people to come in and buy the war bonds. And people would buy, say, they would come in with 20 marks in Germany and buy a 20 mark war bond and hope that, think that they were doing their part, and then they would get that money back plus a little bit of interest in a few years. So they were loaning money to the government. And they were certainly feeling like they contributed to the cause. This is all, as everybody knows from, World War II serials and things, there's always a war bond advertisement on there. Same thing in World War II as World War I. Okay, any other questions? Let me see. I don't see anything on the question answer line. Oh, I need to move in. No, I don't have any questions. Erica asks, oh, thank you, Erica. I wanted to be asked that question. Thank you. And you know, I don't have a picture of James Bailey. I've hunted everywhere for it, but his papers are all at this archive in the Isle of Man, and he was a guy who wrote extensively. He wrote some absolutely wonderful condemnations of the war and condemnations of British policy. He really deserves to be to be published, and maybe I'll have time to do that work someday. I'm now working on a kind of larger view of all this internment and so forth, but he's a very important guy. He tried at the end of the war to make things as smooth for these departing prisoners as he could, these departing internees, and he had friends. I mean, basically, he had friends all over Germany because he had been this personality who essentially made their lives worth living. And then these guys were deported to Germany. So he went back to the Friends Relief Organization, the Quaker Relief Organization, and he said, now that the internment camp is gradually winding down, we have another job, and that's to see if we can't help people in Germany who are at the end of their ropes and their families here in England who are just at the verge of starvation. And so Bailey and another UK Quaker, but a man who had actually come from Germany and been naturalized, and so was able to travel a little more knowledgeably. The two of them went in late 1919, early 1920, to Germany, and his depiction of starving Germany is absolutely overwhelming. I've studied this quite a bit. I know about the hunger blockade. I know how hungry Germans were during the war, and so forth. And I know about the post-war period too, in some detail. My dissertation was about that period, but it was a shock to hear this personal account of a man who would go to, say, Cologne, and set up shop and let it be known among all the internees who had landed in Cologne that to come to him, and they would talk about what resources there were to try to get reunited with their families, or whether they should bring their families over, whether there was any chance that they could come back to Britain. But all of this time, he and his friends were just practically starving. They stopped in Amsterdam, and his friend said, "We've got to go to this cheese store." And he said, "A cheese store?" And he said, "Yes, trust me, we need this cheese." And so they bought a big wheel of cheese, and he said they lugged it all around. But many days in their, I think it was about a two-month trip, many days that was what they had to eat, just a piece of the cheese. They did bring some candy and things for some children of individuals. There was a Quaker, not official, but somebody working with the Quakers, doing some work in one of the German cities, and they took some candy for his kids. And when they came and gave the candy, the kids were just overwhelmed. They had not seen candy in over a year. It's an amazing story, and he describes these events. Gets back to England, finished with his trip, just reunited with his wife. He's a young man. You know, he's probably 30, 32 at this time. Reunited with his wife, and there's a funny story. He wants to go. He's just gotten back over a day, two or three days before, but there's a big meeting of the Friends Relief officials, and he wants to go and be in this big meeting, so they go to the neighboring city. I forget whether it was in Birmingham or where, but his wife says, "Oh, James, here's a drugstore. I've got to go in here. Why don't you just step on that drugstore scale while we're here?" And sure enough, he had lost 30 or 40 pounds in those 2 months, and it determined she wanted him to know that he had some sort of making up to do in his nutrition, in the nutritional area. Anyway. He's a great guy, I think a real hero, and thanks for asking that question so I could talk more about it. let's see. Oh, Laura asks, did the Spanish flu affect military strategy? The flu was known to especially hit our people in the age range that were to be found on the front. That's exactly right, especially people in their 20s. That was strange. I can see battle planning being affected with so many people sick. It is true. It is true that battle planning could be affected. These theories about the Germans and the Austrians losing more from it, I don't know that the evidence is overwhelming on that, and I don't know that there were any plans related to that other than the fact that they just needed they knew they needed more manpower. Now, the Germans were desperate for manpower and began one of the things the Germans did, and I didn't put it in this array of, you know, the war against the individual, though it certainly was. In German rear areas in northern France and in Belgium, they just rounded up people and put them to forced labor. So the forced labor camps of the Second World War were prefigured under Ludendorff. This is only after 1916, but they were prefigured under Ludendorff and Hindenburg in World War One. And so the Germans were doing that, again, to make use of manpower. In other words, if you could stick these people in a munitions factory or even a uniform factory or whatever, then that's, you know, for each person, theoretically, or at some rate of exchange, you get one German soldier out of that. But I don't know of any, I don't know that that this was, that the losses were as apparent to them, except that they just needed to recruit more, and so this there was more recruiting. It's hard to know, but it was an incredible disease. It hit many well-known people and then millions who were not so well-known. One of the most important was Randolph Bourne, in my mind, to me, certainly. Walt Disney got it too, but he survived. That's an answer to your question, I hope. What other questions do we have? I know it's getting a little late, but I'm fine. If you are. Do you have any more questions? I switch screens there for a second. Not on the question and answer. Okay. Does that mean everybody's ready to stop? Maybe it's time. Maybe you have other things to go to, and that you're ready to toss in the towel at this point. Nothing. Kim Ray says nothing. Therefore, I guess we'll end it. So next week, Titanic Wars, and we'll talk more about the war and more about the home front, too, and more about other aspects of all this. So since Cam has announced that it is coffee time, I suggest we all go have a cup of coffee and go on to the next thing. Louis, ask a question. Let me see what it is. Sorry, it's okay. It's fine. If you want to go. I'll answer Louis's question, and then we'll end it. I never heard of Quakers before, except an essay by Rothbard on a free society in Pennsylvania at the beginning. Is this religion? And are they particularly individualist and Pacific, or Bailey and the Quakers from Pennsylvania, etc.? No, they are. Yes, the Quakers are a nonconformist religion from England. That is to say, they were not. They were a group that pulled out of the Anglican Church in the late 1600s, early 1700s, and they were originally called Quakers because they were originally very much a spirit-filled church, and so they would. People said they would quake when they were praying and receiving the spirit and so forth and so on, but they always because their doctrines that involved being simple people, they had a deep distrust of governments as being high and fine and mighty and royal and all that. And they thought it was absolutely a contradiction to kill their fellow human beings. In fact, they thought that everybody was equal, and they spoke, many of the Quakers in England spoke with the informal thee and thou to everybody, not just to their friends, which it was an older kind of affectation, but I mean it's as if they were speaking to and toi to each other, you know, just to everybody, you know, no matter who they saw. Because they said everybody was equal. So they were certainly a peace-related church. In the Americas, their history is they were some of the few settlers who really gave the Indians a fair shake in Pennsylvania. In Europe at large, they've organized many, many relief efforts. They said, well, there's going to be war, and we're not going to take a part in it, but we will help to ameliorate, to make better some of the circumstances. So they've done wonderful things. They've saved people in many, many ways during both wars. So yes, it is, Louis. It is a church, and it's very much related to peace and decency. And so yeah, in a way, Bailey is characteristic of many Quakers. So yeah. Steve Wise says William Penn, founder of Pennsylvania, was a Quaker and established that on the idea of religious freedom. Modern offshoot of the Quakers are called Friends, who tend to be more evangelical but still hold to many of the Quaker doctrines. So, yeah, very much. Richard Nixon was a Friend. That's certainly true as a young man. And so, yeah, that's a good. So they were predisposed, as with many churches. In other words, the Mennonites are a peace church for sure in the Amish. There are peace traditions in other churches too, but these groups are very much peace oriented. Okay, well, shall we close it down now? It's okay with me if we do, and I hope it's okay with you. So let's call it a night. Thank you, Laura, and good night. And I will log off here. Thanks, everybody, and thanks, Louis. Go drink some coffee or other beverage, whatever you like. And good morning to you, Steve. Yeah, have a good morning. Have a good morning. That's great. Okay. Well, so long, everybody. I'm gonna log off.